Genesis 37, the 35th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 7, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 37. We've been working our way through Genesis over the last... It's been about 3 years. And my hope is that in this shot here, the next few weeks, we'll be finishing Genesis up. We'll see if we make it. I know it's been a year. I don't want to recap all of what I talked about last fall, but just very briefly, let me tell you what happens in chapter 36 fits into what preceded it. Genesis, as I see it, is divided into basically three parts. The first part is chapters 1 through 11, in which Moses lays out what is the problem with mankind, and describes the rebellion that is in all of mankind, and that there's no remedy for it. Man can't fix himself. And his rebelliousness is deserving of judgment. And so we have the flood, which destroys all of mankind, except for the 8 on the boat. The next section in Genesis is the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And there what God is doing is he picks out one man. He's kind of an everyman, Abraham. And he enters into Abraham's life. He blesses him, and he transforms Abraham. And Abraham kind of becomes the prototype of what God's solution to the problem is. That God's solution is he is going to come in to individuals, and he is going to bless them and transform them. We see the same process happening with Isaac and Jacob. So the three patriarchs become kind of the paradigm of God's solution to the problem. But God is also establishing through Abraham and his descendants this people. It's a whole line of people that have been set aside for a special purpose. And their special purpose is to be the vehicle through whom God is able to reveal his entire salvific purposes. So in the third part of Genesis, then, we look at the descendants of Jacob, all of whom are heirs of the promise that were made to Abraham. And what we see here is that even these heirs of the promise are wicked sinners. And God still has a process that he's going to take this group through in order to transform them. So we're looking at this section that's often called the Joseph narrative. It deals mostly with Joseph, but it's really about the sons of Jacob. But it focuses on Joseph. It is the longest and most cohesive section in Genesis. It really is, constitutes one story, and it's a very interesting and particularly well-written story. It is striking in that it is so secular. We don't hear God talking in this section. People don't make prayers in this section. They don't offer sacrifices on altars in this section. It's a very, compared with the rest of Genesis, it's particularly secular, which is interesting. But it's nevertheless highly theological. And I think that we'll be seeing that as we progress through. God is always there. He's just slightly behind the obvious. And what we see particularly in this section of Genesis is that the purposes of a holy God are being worked out through worldly sinners. That the two things are coinciding, and it becomes particularly obvious in this section. Okay, how does it fit in with what has just preceded it? The structure of Genesis is pretty overt in a sense. That is, Genesis is 10 genealogical tales all put together. And it's made quite overt in the text, because whenever we come to another genealogical tale, it says these are the generations of. These are the generations of Adam. Then it goes on to talk about Adam's descendants. These are the generations of Abraham. It goes on to talk about Abraham's descendants. So there are 11 of those genealogical segments. This is the last of those. These are the generations of Jacob. That is, this is about Jacob's descendants. The last section, the one that just preceded it, was about the generations of Esau. Esau, as you'll recall, was a son of I'll get it right, Isaac. Esau was a son of Isaac, as was Jacob, but Jacob inherited the promises, Esau did not. So the account of the generations of Esau is quite short, and when we get to the end, we discontinue following his descendants. Jacob, however, comes front and center. He is the heir of the promises made to Abraham and Isaac, and then it is his line that then we will continue to trace. Before we get into chapter 37, let me just very briefly remind you of a few of the events that led up to this, because what happens in 37 has to be understood in the context of what preceded it. What preceded it really sets the stage for these events. As you will recall, Esau and Jacob were both sons of Isaac. Esau was the older. Esau should have been the one, he would have been expected to be the one to inherit the promises. Esau was the favorite of Isaac. And Esau loved to hunt and go out into the fields. He was a woodsman. He was a hunter. And Isaac favored him greatly. Jacob, on the other hand, was the favorite of his mother, Rebekah. And he stayed around the tents. His life was more domestic. He learned to do what his mother did. Well, there arose this tension. Jacob desperately wanted to inherit the promises. And he maneuvered and schemed and deceived in order to make it possible for him to inherit the promises that were given to Isaac, Abraham and Isaac. In particular, there was an incident in which Isaac called in Esau and said, "I want to bless you. But before I bless you, I'd like you to go out and hunt down some game and prepare a meal the way I like it." And so Esau took off to hunt. Rebekah had overheard this, and she informed Jacob of what was happening. And she instructed Jacob to go out and kill a couple goats, cook them, and take the skins from the goats and put them on his arms and on his neck, because Esau was a hairy man, very hairy man, apparently. And then take that into Isaac and receive the blessing in Esau's stead. So Jacob did that. And Jacob did receive the blessing instead of Esau. So then Jacob was forced to flee the area. He went far away to Haran, where he got in contact with Rebekah's family, his mother's family. And there he met Rachel, and he wanted to marry Rachel. But Laban, who was Rebekah's brother, Laban worked things out in such a way that in the marriage night, when it was time for the marriage to be consummated, he had sent Leah instead of Rachel for the consummation of the marriage. So then, when Jacob discovered what had happened, he was outraged and negotiated with Laban to allow him to marry Rachel, but he stayed married to Leah. But he had to work 14 years in exchange for those two wives. Well, that incident spawned a conflict within the family. Leah was not as pretty as Rachel and was not the one that Jacob desperately wanted to marry. And so she felt unloved. And so when she was the first of the two wives to begin to have children, and she had a number of sons. And with each one, her confidence gained that she would now be loved by Jacob because she had provided him with sons. But that did not happen. And desperate for that love, and in competition with Rachel, they gave their maids over to Jacob as wives, and they too had children, surrogate children for their mistresses. So this competition continued between Rachel and Leah for the love of Jacob. And as is very apparent, this competition was passed on to the children. The children became involved in this competition as well. So we have this fairly significant rift within the family. There's tension within the family. Competition between Rachel and her maid and their children, and Leah and her maid and their children. Jacob ends up having 12 sons in all as a result of this competition. And we see in the account in Genesis that the three oldest all find a way to alienate their father, to put distance between themselves and their father. Simeon and Levi decided in response to an incident when they were living near Shechem, in which their sister Dinah was raped by one of the men of Shechem who wanted to marry her. In response to that action, they cooked up a scheme whereby they convinced all of the men of Shechem that in order for them to have an alliance with the children of Abraham, they all needed to be circumcised. And while they were still recovering from the operation, Simeon and Levi led an attack on Shechem and killed all of the men of Shechem. Well, this vengeance and their impetuous anger alienated them from Jacob. He was very upset by what they had done. Reuben, who was the very oldest, also alienated his father when he slept with his father's concubine, Bilhah, who was the maid of Rachel. To sleep with one's father's either concubine or wife was a way of making a claim to your father's position of authority. Now, exactly how that works and how they think of that is not crystal clear to me, but there is that pattern. We do see that in the Old Testament. And so Reuben's act of sleeping with Bilhah is not just an act of passion, but it is a political act in a sense. It is making a claim to his father's authority. So once again, we have an incident which alienates Jacob from one of his sons. That means that Jacob has reason to distrust, to have concerns about all of his three oldest children. And that will be important to keep in mind as we progress. Okay, so that's the background. That's the high points of what you need to remember in order to launch into chapter 37. Let's look at the first 11 verses. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a vari-colored tunic. And his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. And so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream. And when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. And he said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. And lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now he had still another dream and related it to his brothers and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." And he related it to his father and to his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" And his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. Okay, at this very beginning is really a transition from the discussion of Esau and his descendants. And it makes an interesting switch of verbs here that I think is significant. It says, now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned. Abraham and Isaac had seen their stay in Canaan as just being a sojourn. They are just passing through. Esau didn't see Canaan as his at all. He has left and has gone further south, has left Canaan completely. Jacob, however, is living in Canaan. He's dwelling in Canaan. So Jacob is seeing this as his home. He's the first one of the patriarchs to see this as his home. It's ironic that he will not end up dying here. God is working in such a way that he has moved from Canaan before he dies. Then it gives the title of this section, "These are the generations of Jacob." So now we know that we will be looking at the descendants of Jacob. Now, as best as I can put together the chronology of Genesis, this is happening sometime around 1800 BC, the events that unfold here. Jacob is 108 years old at this time. Isaac, his father, is still alive. He's 168 years old, and he will live another 12 years before he dies. Joseph is 17. Reuben, who is his oldest brother, is about 30. So there's about, 13 years difference between Reuben and Joseph. There is one younger, Benjamin, and he was born, I don't remember how many years after Joseph he was born, but Rachel died giving birth to Benjamin. Joseph, we are told, is 17 years old. He's a very young man, and he's working as apparently an apprentice shepherd. It says in the NASB that it says he was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth. Well, the word for youth can also mean apprentice, and that seems to be a better fit for this passage, that he's working as a shepherd apprentice under the supervision of his brothers, who are the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah. They would be the ones who would be closest in age to him. So he is essentially an apprentice shepherd, working closely with his next older brothers. There is an interesting turn of phrase here. The way that it says it in the Hebrew, it says that he was pasturing with his brothers. Literally, it's he was pasturing with his brothers. But those same words could be read to mean he was ruling over his brothers. And there seems to be a literary device that's used in the Hebrew narratives that's called anticipatory paranomasia, which means that there's a phrase that can be taken two ways. In context, it can only mean one, but the first time you look at it, it passes through your mind. It could be the other, and the other somehow comes true later in the story. So it's a kind of foreshadowing device. That's one of the things. There are a number of things in this narrative, devices like that, that have been used, and I will bring some of them to your attention, but it shows that this narrative is a really tight text. It is very highly crafted, and it seems ludicrous to me to apply the documentary hypothesis to this section of Genesis in particular and think that this came about by pasting together pieces written by different authors. It is so tightly written that seems entirely implausible to me. Okay, the text then goes on to list three reasons why Joseph's brothers hate him. The first one is Joseph brought a bad report about his brothers to his father. Now, it doesn't tell us whether that bad report was fictitious or not. It leaves open the possibility that he manufactured some bad report. But there's no real indication that that's the case. And I'm going to argue that I don't think it's the case. And we know that his brothers are capable of bad behavior. He has observed them doing something that they should not do. So he's put in that awkward position that we've all probably experienced one time or another, when we've observed our peers doing something they ought not do, and we're faced with this dilemma: do I inform the authority about what the peers have done because they ought not have done it? Or do we keep our solidarity with our peers? So he's put in this position between a rock and a hard place. And for him, it seems to be a no-brainer. They did wrong. I will tell. I mean, that seems to be, I will argue later, I think Joseph has a very black and white view of the world. It's not very nuanced. And for him, it's a no-brainer. They did wrong. I tell Dad. And that's what he did. Obviously, his brothers then are going to look at that and say, he broke solidarity with us. And that is dangerous, Because that means that our freedom of operation to do what we want to do is curtailed whenever he's around. And that's a problem. The second reason for their hatred of Joseph is that Joseph is clearly the favorite of his father Jacob. Joseph refers to him as Jacob's son in his old age. Well, Benjamin is even younger, so Benjamin probably more rightly deserves that title. However, Benjamin was born under very sad circumstances. Rachel died in the process. So there seems to be something special about Joseph. Joseph was born to his favorite wife and under better circumstances. It is interesting here that Jacob shows favoritism towards Joseph, even though Jacob was the victim of his father's favoritism towards Esau. The very thing that Jacob did not like in his father, he repeats. He does himself. And I find it interesting how often it is the case that the very things in our parents that we see and say, I don't want to do things that way, there's something strong in us that pulls us to repeat those same things. So Jacob made him this tunic. Now the term, it's translated a varicolored or multicolored tunic. In the Hebrew, the word tunic just means a long coat. The adjective that's translated varicolored, in Hebrew, we don't know what that means. It only occurs one other time in the Old Testament, and in that context, it's not clear exactly what it means. All it is some kind of tunic that's worn by the daughter of a king. If etymologically, it would appear that the Hebrew word means extending to the palms. So etymologically, the best guess would be that this is a tunic that has sleeves that extend clear down to the hands, and the coat part of it goes clear down to the ankles. So that's etymologically, that's the best guess. However, the Septuagint, which is an old Greek translation of the Hebrew by Old Testament into Greek, it uses the Greek word for multicolored. So that's why that term has been used in our translations. And in more recent times, there have been found wall paintings depicting inhabitants of Canaan dressed in their native garb, and some of them wearing multicolored tunics. So presumably this is a long tunic that was typically multicolored, and that's what Jacob has made for his son. And it seems to be indicative of some kind of special social standing to have this kind of coat. Jacob, the one who was raised as a domestic, has sewn then for his son this tunic. His brothers, in response to this, develop a hatred so deep they can't even be civil to him. And the Hebrew seems to indicate, even in face of his best attempts to be pleasant towards them, they rebuff those overtures, and they become very jealous. The third reason, then, for their hatred of Joseph is a pair of dreams that Joseph has. It was generally assumed in this time, in this culture, that dreams were oftentimes of divine origin and that they were predictive. And especially if you have the same dream being repeated, or the theme of the same dream repeated, that indicates that it wasn't just a freak dream, but that rather it was meant to be communication, divine communication. So that's the background behind the significance of these dreams. In the first dream, Joseph and his brothers are out harvesting in the field, and they're putting together the grain into sheaves. And Joseph's sheaf then stands up, and his brother's sheaves gather around his sheaf, and they all bow down. Joseph tells this story to his brothers, and his brothers are outraged. Now, Joseph doesn't offer any interpretation of this. He just tells them the story. The brothers immediately understand the significance of it. At least they think they do. No one seems to question the significance of it. They all assume what the significance is. And the brothers see it as indicating that Joseph thinks that he will one day be in a position of authority over them. And they're outraged. You think that you will rule over us? You think that you will, and the second verb that he uses seems to have the connotation of tyrannize us. So they see this, him telling them this dream, as being extremely impudent and obnoxious. It is interesting that by this time the text has mentioned three times that Joseph's brothers hated him. And the dream seems to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. The favoritism and telling on them, those both laid the groundwork, but it's the dream that really sets them off. And there is a constant play on words here, because Joseph's name means added to, because when he was born, Rachel said, "This God will add to my joy," or something like that. So here, everything Joseph does adds to their hatred for him. Then he relates a second dream. The second dream is a little bit different, but the theme is clearly very similar. In the second dream, there are 11 stars and the sun and the moon that all bow down to Joseph. And Joseph tells this to his brothers. And then, and I don't know whether it's at his brother's prompting or whether it's at Joseph's initiative, Joseph then tells it to both his father and his brothers. And his father, too, nobody questions the interpretation. Everybody assumes that the meaning is quite clear, that Joseph is going to be in a position of authority over the rest of his family. And Jacob's response at first is a kind of outrage. It's kind of, you think that you are going to be over us and that we are going to bow down? And he exaggerates what the dream had actually said, bow down to the ground to you. And so he rebukes Joseph for his, well, we'll talk about what he's rebuking him for a little bit later. But then Jacob, in reflecting on it, his response becomes different. He ponders this. He stores it up in his heart. It's reminiscent of what it says about Mary and the things that Jesus did. She treasured those things in his heart. So we have two very different responses to this potentially offensive actions by Joseph. His brothers come to hate him intensely. Jacob is immediately put off, but then he begins to ponder it in his heart. And those two reactions become really significant as we proceed. The next section, verses 12 through 17. Then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them. And he said to him, I will go. Then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, what are you looking for? And he said, I am looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock. Then the man said, they have moved from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. So we have an incident here where after they have developed this intense hatred for Joseph, the brothers have gone off a long way. They've gone off to Shechem to shepherd the sheep and the goats. Now, whenever I am thinking about the geography of Palestine, I use the Willamette Valley as my point of reference. Palestine is about the size of the Willamette Valley. From Eugene to Portland is about the length of Palestine. And it is narrow at the north and widens out at the south, as does the Willamette Valley, which reaches its widest point, I think, about it at Brownsville. So he is going from Hebron, which is way down south, to a point that is most of the way north. So it's about 60 miles, about the distance from Eugene to Salem. So he's going about that far to find his brothers. Then he finds out that it's another 15 miles further, so he goes on to Woodburn. So they're a long ways away, and they're at Shechem. Shechem's a bad place for descendants of Jacob, because remember the incident that had happened at Shechem. So I suspect that's the reason that Jacob's worried about them. He wants to make sure that they're okay, because they're shepherding flocks in a dangerous area. So he sends Joseph to check on them to see how things are coming. Now, why would Jacob send Joseph knowing that there is tension between Joseph and his brothers? Isn't he just asking for trouble? I don't think that Jacob is aware of the intensity of the feelings. I mean, I suspect as a parent, he's thinking, well, I know there's some tension there, but they would never do anything to harm Joseph. So I don't think that he really believes that harm is a possibility, harm coming to Joseph from his brothers. And we'll talk a little bit later about why Joseph is willing to go. Okay, he goes on this trip, 50 miles, 50, 60 miles. He gets there. They aren't there. And so Joseph is just wandering around trying to find them. And while he's wandering around, a man comes along and finds, as the text says, finds Joseph. And he just happens to know that the ones that Joseph is looking for have already gone. And he just happens to have overheard them say that they were going to Dothan. Weird things happen. And that's the way we're going to see this theme throughout this narrative of Joseph, that weird things happen. It's just thinly veiled description of God's activity behind the scenes. I mean, the author clearly wants us to see God's activity behind the scenes. This is not an accident. And had he not been found by this man, Joseph probably would have been forced to just go back, not having made contact with his brothers. So him being found by this man makes it possible for him to make contact with his brothers, which then sets in motion this chain of events that God had in store all along. Okay, so Joseph then goes to Dothan. When he's still a distance away, the brothers look at him and they see him. And you can just imagine the scene. They hate this guy. And they see him walking up to them at a distance, but he's wearing this coat. I mean, it's like a red cloth in front of a bull. I mean, it's flaunting. It's just increasing the outrage. So they immediately, as they see him, they say, the master dreamer. So the dream is the reason for the offense. It's the dream that is the most disturbing to them. So he's coming, and I'm sure they're thinking, yeah, he's coming to spy on us. He's coming to find more reports of bad news to carry back to our father. So they immediately go into this scheming mode where they plot to kill him. They are, after all, 65 miles away from their dad? So they're thinking, we've got a lot of room to maneuver here. There's a lot of distance between us and our father. And we can do what we want to do. And this guy's a problem. We can get rid of our problem. So the scheme that they come up with is they're going to kill him. They're going to say that they're going to hide the corpse then in a cistern. And a cistern, they're fairly common in Palestine, in ancient Palestine. Water is scarce. So what they would do is dig in the ground a cistern, a round bowl, essentially, that narrows out at the top. And then you could fill it with water, and it won't evaporate, and then you can use a bucket to get it out when you need the water. So there are cisterns that dotted the area, and this is just another one. So their thinking is, we'll kill him, put him in the cistern, and nobody will ever find him. At least not before he's decomposed. And we'll say wild beasts got him. And that's their solution to the problem of this brother of theirs and his dreams. They say at the end of their scheme, then let us see what will become of his dreams. While he's still coming, though, Reuben, who's the oldest and who is responsible here, he's the responsible person, he comes up quickly with a counterproposal. Killing Joseph, that's going too far. But he's not willing to stand up to his brothers and say, that's wrong, we aren't going to do anything to him. He comes up with this intermediate solution. We will dispose of Joseph, but we just won't kill him. And his plan is, take Joseph, put him in a cistern in the wilderness, out in the middle of nowhere, and we'll just let him die there. No water, it won't take long. He'll just die. But Reuben is thinking, that will give me the opportunity to come back later and save him. So that's the counter proposal. It's at that time, apparently, that Joseph arrives. And my suspicion is Joseph was shocked at the behavior of his brothers. His brothers take him, they take his coat off of him, they throw him, they toss him into the cistern with no water, and he's going to die either of exposure or thirst before long. It doesn't indicate in this narrative how Joseph responded to this, but there are indications elsewhere that Joseph pleaded with them to spare his life. But they turned a deaf ear to those pleadings and put him in the cistern. Um, And this must have been particularly shocking to Joseph because he's come to make sure their welfare is, they're okay. That's his mission. And I think he's really doing that in good faith. At this point then, Reuben apparently leaves. And Judah then comes up with a counterproposal. They've put Joseph in the cistern, and they're sitting around eating dinner. So these events have not dampened their appetites. They're able to eat right after they've done this. They're sitting down to eat, and again they see something off in the distance. No reason to think it's not the same group. Ishmaelite seems to be in description of the lifestyle of these people. Midianites is their ethnicity, what ethnic group they actually are attached to. And so what the distinction is, they are Ishmaelites in the sense that someone would say they're gypsies. Well, gypsy isn't necessarily an ethnic term, it's a lifestyle. It can be an ethnic term, but it's not necessarily an ethnic term. Midianites is necessarily an ethnic term. Well, it's interesting that they're looking off and seeing these Ishmaelites, because we have seen previously in Genesis another story in which jealousy overcame someone. Jealousy with response to someone who is inheriting the promises of God. And that was Ishmael. If you'll recall, when Isaac was born, Ishmael made fun of Isaac. Ishmael was jealous of Isaac because Isaac was going to inherit. Ishmael was not. Ishmael was unable to bring himself to a point where he rejoiced in the birth of the son that would further God's promises and could only focus on what was going to be deprived of him, and became jealous. And so I think it's significant that these are Ishmaelites that they see in the distance. Judah then gives his counter proposal. And his counter proposal is, let's not leave him in the cistern to die. Let's not kill him. We don't want to have blood on our hands. We don't want to have to deal with a dirty conscience. So let's do something that accomplishes the same purposes without getting blood on our hands. He suggests that they sell him to these Ishmaelites to be taken into slavery. They won't have blood on their hands. Joseph will be gone forever. And they get 20 shekels of silver on top of it all. Such a deal. So that's compelling to them. That's what they decide to do. Okay, second to last section, 18 through 28. Oh, I haven't read that, have I? Oh my goodness. Let me go back to 18. When they saw him from a distance, I didn't read this, did I? Okay, when they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. And they said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, let us not take his life. Reuben further said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father. So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty, without any water in it. Then they sat down to eat a meal, And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead, with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh, on their way to bring them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. Okay, now this last section. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his garments. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. So Reuben comes back and discovers that Joseph is gone. And so Reuben doesn't know what's happened. All he knows is the boy is gone, and his response is, "Now where do I go? What's going to become of me?" Obviously, his concern is more on himself rather than the fate of Joseph. So apparently, Reuben and the rest of the brothers concoct this plan. What they're going to do is take the coat that they had stripped off of him, and they're going to kill a kid goat in order to deceive their father. They're going to take the blood from the kid goat and going to smear it on the coat. And then they send the coat to their father. And the text makes it sound like they send it on ahead before they arrive. Then they arrive and ask the question, "Is this your son's coat?" I mean, they're playing dumb. They don't suggest what happened. They just say, "Is this your coat? Is this your son's coat?" And they let Jacob then jump to the conclusion of what has happened. And he makes the conclusion that they wanted him to make, that a beast has attacked him and torn him to pieces. Jacob then mourns the death of his son. And it's almost chilling here to read the words, "Then his sons and all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him." His sons know what's happened. Their comfort is all a sham. Their attempts to comfort him is all a sham. And yet they go through this charade to cover their tracks. Meanwhile, Joseph is being taken off to Egypt, where he's sold as a slave. Okay, there are just a couple of points that I want to make. The first one is, what did Joseph contribute to the tension between him and his brothers? How much, clearly, the brothers are the ones that are primarily being depicted as being at fault here. But to what extent has Joseph contributed to that? Virtually all of the commentaries that I looked at see Joseph as contributing to this problem. One commentary has this sentence: "God's future agent and mouthpiece in Egypt could hardly make a worse impression on his first appearance. Spoiled brat, talebearer, braggart. So he's looking at everything that Joseph has done as being character flaws, that there's a maliciousness in Joseph's character. I don't read it that way. I don't think that's what's going on. If that's what's going on, it makes a difference as we proceed, because then we're going, it would appear then that we can watch some change in character of Joseph, because that's not the kind of person we see later in the narrative. But I don't think that's what's happening. I think Joseph is just naive. Joseph is basically clueless. He's 17. At 17, the world is black and white. In 17, you wonder why generations of people who preceded you didn't solve the problems of mankind, the solutions which are so obvious to you. And so he's looking out at this world, and he sees his brothers doing wrong. What do you do about that? Well, you tell Dad. It doesn't even occur to him to take into account what the impact that his actions are going to have on his brothers. It just doesn't even occur to him. He's very single-minded in this. He sees something wrong, you report it. So this statement that he's a spoiled brat, tale-bearer, and braggart, I think that is the way his brothers see him, but I don't think that's the way that the narrator wants us to see him. The narrator could have clearly just changed a few words to indicate fault, maliciousness on Joseph's side, but he doesn't do that. I see no hints of actual malicious intent. So, he gets a coat from his father. He is proud of his relationship with his father. So he walks around with his coat on. He's clueless as to what kind of impact that has on his brothers. He's not taking that into account at all. The dreams. I really think he told them to his brothers because he thought, hey, that's a cool dream. They're in it. I'm going to tell them. They'll find it interesting too. I really think he's clueless. And there are other indications that he's clueless. One is when his father is going to send him 65 miles away to see his check on his brothers, he says, sure, I'll go. He's clueless as to the degree of the tension between him and his brothers. So he volunteers. And then when he's going to see his brothers, I mean, if he had any idea how his brothers felt about him, he would not be walking up wearing the coat. That would be in his backpack somewhere at the bottom. I mean, he's not going to parade up there with the coat on. So it seems to me the text is indicating not that he's malicious, it's just he's clueless. He's 17. He just doesn't understand the impact of his actions on other people. That takes time. And so I'm inclined to see then the story in Genesis, this Joseph narrative, it's not Joseph's character being transformed as much as Joseph just growing up. We see maturation. That's significant also because I think it pours more blame then on the brothers. It really is the brothers that have, they're unwilling to give their brother the room and treat him with patience and allow him to grow up. They're too quick to find him at fault. Let me look then just a little bit and analyze the brother's hatred. Jealousy is an interesting thing. Jealousy ultimately stems from discontent. That is, I look at my situation And my attitude more towards my situation is, I deserve better. Things really ought to be better for me. Then jealousy is when we see someone else who in some respect has it better than us. And they become then the lightning rod for our discontent. They become the problem. And it's very easy for us to think in terms of, if that person was out of the picture, things would be fine, rather than focusing on the discontent within us. And that discontent within us ultimately stems from a rebelliousness towards God. Why has God put me in this situation? He ought not. I deserve better. So jealousy transforms that discontent, which is rooted in a rebelliousness towards God, and focuses all of that on some external cause of my problems, the person of whom I am jealous. And that's what's happened to them, that they see Joseph now as the problem. So Joseph, as all of their interactions with him, he is a walking irritant. I mean, everything he does irritates and reminds them of their discontent and how they deserve better. He values rightness, so he tells on them. Well, that's a source of friction, because they want to be able to do what they want to do and not have someone who's going to tell on them. And he seems to be indicating that he has a divine promise that he will one day have authority over them. That is intolerable to them. The mere thought of that is outrageous and cannot happen. And in the back of their minds, they must be thinking, they're outwardly thinking, oh, that's just a silly dream. He's just an arrogant fool. But in the back of their minds, they're thinking, but what if? We must take every action we possibly can to make sure that he is never put in that position, never allowed to get into that position. That's why he has to be killed. I have, until I looked at Genesis this last time, it had not occurred to me how our response to the things of God were really rooted in our attitude towards God himself. But it's becoming clearer to me. I think that's a theme that we see in various places in Genesis. I think we saw it with Ishmael and his response to the birth of Isaac. And we see it here, the brothers and their response to Joseph. When he tells them the dream, they are outraged. This cannot happen. It cannot be that I would be stuck in subservience to my brother, which would only multiply my discontent. I refuse to live in a universe that's run by a God who would do that to me. And that's the attitude behind it. We have another attitude that's manifested here, however, and that's Jacob, who says, oh, you're going to rule over us? He's immediately outraged. But then he stops and he ponders it. What if it's so? And rather than being outraged, he just keeps it in the back of his mind. That would be a curious thing that God would do if he did it. That is essentially the two responses that people can have to the things that God is doing. And it seems to me that we see in the Old Testament then the response of other peoples to what God is doing among his chosen nation, the Israelites, is a similar kind of thing. The surrounding peoples will either be outraged because in the back of their minds they're thinking they really could be the chosen people of God. But we will do everything that we can to make sure that never comes to pass. So we see that kind of dynamic at work in the way that people respond to the people of God, his chosen nation. We also see it, I think, in the life of Jesus. Here comes someone, the Son of God. And again, that same choice between responses. Either outrage, because if that's the way the universe is, if that's the kind of God we serve, I want nothing to do with it. Those plans have to be foiled, no matter what it takes from us. We will kill him. Or we ponder it in our hearts. What if it's true? And how will I respond? So Jesus then becomes really a very good barometer of our attitude towards God. And how we respond to him is indicative of what we think of God and how we think about what he's doing in the universe. Okay. I have gone over time. So I will save extra time next week for questions in order to have mercy on those taking care of children. We'll cut it off here. Thanks.